Accession number 31693, reel 19.
In reel 19. Now, you were talking about the fact that you got into some trouble. What happened then?
We were in the local town and we were celebrating the same as everybody else was, the end of our training, because we were going up country. And the Sing Platoon were renowned as being very, very close, and we were. If somebody got in trouble, the other guys always used to come together. We were a very, very close family knit platoon. 30 odd of us in the platoon, very, very close. And it was a case of two officious sergeants who picked on us particular signallers, because we were the only signallers in this particular bar. Although there was other, there was company in there, rather than going to them, to the company, because they were company sergeants as well, platoon sergeants, and they came to us first and told us to drink our drinks and get out, and we said, well, we'll go when everybody else goes, and Norman took exception to this, and I don't know exactly what happened, but Norman was thrown in the clink, and we went back, and we three were told to go up to our rooms, and we thought that was it, but unfortunately it wasn't. And I mean, one or two people thought that we'd been unfairly treated, and one or two people had said to me, you should put in a notice. I'm forgetting what the word is now, but it's a notice which you think. I thought, no, it's happened. I'm disappointed because I was due for promotion again, and I've just got to get on with it. And as I say, it just made me more determined, that was all.
Were you without a stripe for any length of time?
All the way through Borneo.
It's quite a while.
6 months. It wasn't so much that, but later on, something else cropped up which deal with.
So when your training had ended, did you go back to Hong Kong before you went to Borneo?
No. We actually finished the training and packed up the camp at... and went down to Jesselton. Some guys went by troop ship from Jesselton down to Kuching. I was at battalion headquarters because I was a battalion headquarters signaller. At that time, before I got demoted, I was one of the NCOs in charge of battalion headquarters signals. I still was because I was very experienced, and if I say so myself, I was a good signaller, and went down to Jesselton, flew down to Kuching as an advance party to take over the signals equipment from the Green Jackets. Got into, I think the place was Côte d'Alloud, was the battalion headquarters. Went in there and started taking over all the equipment there and getting ready for the battalion coming down and going into their different positions.
This is in Borneo itself now.
This is in Sarawak. Yeah. We were, although we weren't right upon the border at battalion headquarters, we were sufficiently up there where the CO could actually take command of the companies, and but we were still there was another battalion at a place called Semangang, which is halfway between Kuching and our company, our battalion headquarters. We'd actually packed all our gear off. There was a B echelon in Kuching, and a colour sergeant Durham, who looked after all the rear party echelon, all the equipment, all our civilian clothes and everything else, which was all packed away and to be picked up later when we finished our tour. And we actually got a Kuching into trucks, and we drove all the way up to battalion headquarters. Obviously the companies was a little bit more different in that they went by helicopter up into their forward positions, and we had three positions at first. A company who were, I'm trying to think, A company where their positions were. C company was in Nabong. Headquarters was at, I think it was Kortebalud.
This is where you were.
This is where I was, at battalion headquarters. And I must admit, I was pleasantly surprised when I got to headquarters, because we were in huts. We were at proper beds, bunk beds. So I was pleasantly surprised. Obviously, we had to have certain drills, because we all had to have stand-to positions. Because even though we're in a rear area, we were still prone to attack from the, not so much the regular Indonesian soldiers, but there was a Chinese communist element helped by the Indonesians. They were feeding them, they were bringing them over the border into rear areas, because areas like Semanggang and Kuching, they were attacked by these communists, helped by the regular Indonesian army. And once all the battalion, the companies were in position, that's when we started doing the patrols out in the jungle, looking for the regular Indonesian troops and the Chinese, because they were still attacking and all these areas in Sarawak.
Can we just look at your headquarter camp for starters? Was it still a jungle area that you?
It was a jungle area. It was secondary jungle. I mean, there was no thick jungle around us, although within a few hundred yards there was, and we also had a little village not very far from us, although we weren't allowed to go down there. We were if I remember rightly, we were confined to camp into our little base. And
how large was it? Was it a big camp?
It was fairly large.
Take a battalion headquarters.
We took a battalion headquarters, and if I remember, because we also had we had to have protection. So I'm not quite sure how big the protection grew. It wasn't as big as a company, but it wasn't. But it was over platoon size, because we had to have the CO protected, and also we had our helicopters there, and we had Army Air Corps with us, helicopters, because the RSM, RSM Ford, used to be in charge of the helicopters there. To go out to, we weren't doing a refeed there, or the drops. They were done from Kuching with the RAF and the Australian Air Force. But we used to have to do local patrols around the area to make sure that, you know, we weren't attacked by the communists or the Indonesians.
Can we just dwell a little bit longer on the camp? You know, the facilities of the camp, what were they? I'm thinking in terms again of cookhouse.
We had each base had their ESCC chefs, and the meals back in battalion quarters were, considering where we were, that we were in active service, were quite good. And we also had a naffy, and the naffy was run by, if I remember rightly, Toc H. And or probably we had both. And these old ladies, two old ladies, used to come up. I don't know whether they're from Semanggang or not, or the local village, and they used to come and open it up. And
these were native women, were they?
No, these were European women. In their, I would say, in their 50s, maybe 60s, living in the area, and they used to come up and they used to open it, and we used to be able to buy tea and sandwiches, and just like anywhere else, it was quite good, really. And then at a night time, the naffy was open, and we were allowed 2 beers per night, or 2 soft drinks, exactly the same as up in the platoon headquarters, up in company headquarters. They were allowed to, because you were only allowed 2 beers, 2 cans of Coke. Not 2 and 2, but 2 or 2. And we used to have, if I remember rightly, yes, we did. We had money, so it would spend it as normal with them. In the naffy and the Toc H, so we were still paid in cash.
This was English cash, Englishman.
Yes. No, it was in Malayan currency, which I was trying to figure out, because later on there's a story attached to cigarettes, which I'll come on to later. So we. And of course, while we were there, we still had people coming over and joining us who were being posted to us. And of course, they hadn't been trained. They hadn't been trained in the jungle. So we had to train them. And we did have one training session, taking people out on patrol. And I volunteered for it, because my relationship with my platoon commander at the time wasn't particularly good, so I thought, well, I'd rather go out in the jungle.
Who was the platoon commander that you were
at that time?
With?
Captain Churchill.
Yeah.
And
name, yes.
We weren't on good terms, shall I say. I must admit I used to do more than my share of duties, just to get away. And I volunteered to take out, when I say I take out, I was the communications as a signaller. Sergeant Major Ryan was the man. He was ex wartime soldier, I believe, and I do believe he served in the Far East, in the jungle, which made him an ideal guy to take out these people who'd freshly arrived at a draft from England. And I remember we went out, and there was, as a signaller, we actually were taken out into the jungle, and to teach them jungle skills. And we actually went out. I can't remember if we were, yes, we were. We were actually taken, picked up by helicopter, because again, helicopter drills are different in the jungle as well. In that,
can you take me through that whilst we've mentioned this? What was the helicopter drill in the jungle, as it were?
Right. What you would do was the first section would go out. The helicopter would never land. The first section would go out and clear the area to make sure it was safe to bring other troops in. Then the next lot would come in. The signaler would come in on the next group, because we'd have communications, and we would be brought in. We'd be able to land. Because it's damn hard jumping out of a helicopter with a radio on your back.
What kind of height would the jump be?
Oh, you'd be hovering about the height of the roof. So what did you say? With equipment, and you would. So you would maybe a little bit lower, but you would jump out, and they would clear there. Because a helicopter would never ever land before the ground is actually cleared, because there might be mines with the lead. Anyway, we'd come in, we'd go out away from the area where we would be dropped. So everybody would take a position. Once the final lot was brought in, we would go out. And I remember crossing this river. And it would be about, I would say, just below the knees.
Is this with the people you trained?
We took out the train, and we'd get into a position, and we'd clear the area, and we'd set out our permanent camp. You've got to remember that we are fairly well behind the lines, but we're still liable to attack. And I set up with this lad, and you would pair up, and you would be in the bivvy together. And when I say a bivvy, you would make your bed, he would lie side by side, we'd have a poncho over the top, we'd try and make ourselves as comfortable as possible. And some people prefer to make a hammock, and some people prefer to have a bed on the ground, but not on the ground, but up. And there's certain ways of making the bed, certain ways of making a hammock. Because if you make a hammock and you hang it between two trees and you put a bivvy over the top, but there's a certain way. Because if you put the two side poles on and never put any bottom poles on the end, of course you close up and you can't get out. People would have to get you out. But it was made so that you would actually make it so that you would have a bit of rope, or you would use a bit of a vine and tie them up. And so you would make it nice and comfortable. Similarly, if you made a one on the bottom, you'd have two forks, you put it in the ground, and you would put your bed, your side struts, you put them on, and you'd make yourself comfortable. I mean, if you were only staying one night, it was different. You would make it as basic as possible. But if you had a base that you were going to stay in for a fair while, for a few nights, then what you would do, you would make yourself as comfortable as possible. And this is what we did when we took these trainees out. And I remember, as I say, going across the river, and it was the shallow, just below the knees. And we set up our base camp, and it wasn't very far from a kampong, because we used to do Hearts and Minds as well, because we used to have a medic with us, and we'd go into the we'd go on a day patrol and just show these new lads how to go on ambush drills and everything else, how to set up little camps, how to set up ambushes. And I remember very, very well, we'd been the local chief, and actually it was him and a few of the villagers had these problems, and our medic dealt with them. And the next thing we know, loads of fresh fruit was brought to us. They knew where we were, but in a way it was good, because they would have tipped us off if there was any Indonesians in the area. So the next thing we know, they were up there with the fruit. There was coconuts, there was bananas, there was all jungle fruits, which was good for you, you know. They brought them to us, and the chief brought his daughter. She was about 12, 14, and because we'd treated him in the... He said to Sergeant Major Ryan, "You can marry my daughter now." But obviously, we had turned down the offer of Sergeant Major Ryan marrying this daughter, and we had to say it in such a way that we didn't upset them. Said, and he said, "But I'm married in England, you know, I can't have another wife in England." So the chief accepted that, you know, and he didn't get upset about it. But honestly, they looked after us.
And how did you converse with them? I mean, was there a language problem?
We had an interpreter with us, and he actually said, "Oh, there will be no, because Indonesians or Chinese are coming," and they actually kept a guard out for us as well. But the kampongs, I mean, everybody lived in the house, and it was I can't remember what the name of the house now, what they used to call it now, but they were all the families lived on one floor, and all the animals were underneath it, and of course they just had basic toilets. I mean, everything was given to the animals, you know, the pigs and everything else. But they were very, very friendly. I did try while I was out there the local drink, and it was called tuak, and it's made from palm leaf oil. Very, very potent. Can I remember many years later seeing Prince Philip? They'd been to visit one of these villages and gone to one of the houses, and he had two or three tuaks. And he was fairly legless, but they were very friendly. But while we're on this, doing this, one of the guy had parted up with, and I would go out with a section, with the instructors and with the radio equipment, and keeping in contact with the base and also battalion headquarters. And we had our various signals stuff to do, because we also had our equipment, we had our secret equipment, what they call Slidex. And Slidex was, if any messages had to be put into code, we would do it. And we had our codes, which used to last, and some was for 12 hours, some for 24 hours. And like grid references would be encoded. And Very basic, very, very basic chord. And obviously, Vitalik quarters, it would come from them. They would give me the chords, and they would have to be kept at all times.
So these close letter, to me. Letter codes?
Letter codes, and Slidex was letter and number codes. And your grid reference codes as well. And they would last 12 hours, 24 hours. Once you'd used them, they were burnt. Obviously, if you those that would, at the end of the patrol, you would if you couldn't obviously if you were up in the front lines, you couldn't burn it. You had to take it back. But yeah, we'd do that. And when we came back into our little hide, the guy who was my he would go out the next day, but he would make my meal. I remember going out on the first one and coming back, and he'd made my meal, and he said, "I've made a curry." I said, "I don't eat curry." I said, 2 years I spent in Hong Kong, I never ate one curry. I said, "Don't eat." Well, he says, "It's either that or nothing." And that is how I came to like curry, because he made a beautiful curry, but he made it in such a way where it had sultanas, nuts, bananas. So it was called a Malayan curry, which I didn't know at the time, but that's what it was.